If we date the beginning of Stalinism from 1923-24, it has already had a lifespan of over 40 years. This career breaks into two different periods. First, the 30 years from 1923 to 1953. Approximately from the time of Lenin's death to that of Stalin. This witnessed the rise and consolidation of the bureaucratic reaction in the Soviet Union and throughout world communism. The past 14 years have seen the beginnings of the decline and disintegration of Stalinism. To understand the underlying and principal causes for the weakening of Stalinism, it's necessary to recall the main reasons for its victory and its strength. The five most weighty of these I itemized in my first talk, but I'll review them briefly. There was first the defeats of the world revolution, the failure of the workers to win power in any other country except Russia. The second flowed from that fact. The isolation of the Soviet Union in an imperialist world. The third was the inherited low level of Soviet economy. The fourth associated with it, the cultural backwardness of the predominantly peasant population. The fifth, the weakness, the weariness, the smallness of the working class after its heroic exertions from 1917 on. These primary conditions provided the foundation and framework that enabled the bureaucratic elements and privileged sections of Soviet society to beat those communists who stayed true to Lenin's Bolshevism, to crush and crucify them, to erect a totalitarian dictatorship in place of the seething democracy of the early years of the Soviet Republic, and impose domestic and foreign policies suited to the maintenance of their sovereignty, regardless of what damage was done, whether witting or unintentional, to the course of socialism, and no matter what dangers were incurred by the interests of the Soviet Union itself. The ideological justification for this entire course was the conception of building socialism in one country and the subordination of every other consideration to that goal. All these objective supports for Stalinism have been undermined since 1953. By the changes that have taken place in the basic international and internal conditions over the past 24 years. And that's what I propose to focus on tonight. This process of reversal, first of all, began in the world arena during the upheavals of the Second World War. The turning point came in 1943 with three events Some of us lived through them, others may have heard about them. They were the fall of Mussolini in July 1943, the military victory at Stalingrad, and the emergence of the Yugoslav Revolution. The first two developments signaled and heralded the downfall of Italian and German fascism, which had been sweeping all before it in the 30s and early 40s. The Yugoslav events signaled the resurgence of a victorious worker-peasant revolutionary wave. In class terms, that is, the workers and peasants began to resume their offensive against the capitalists and the landlords who had been weakened by the reckless gamble of the German imperialists. The tottering of European capitalism, the entry of the Soviet armies into Eastern Europe, and the triumph of Tito's forces simultaneously broke the isolation from which the Soviet Union had suffered ever since its birth, and immensely extended its influence both on that key continent and in world affairs. The first worker state rose to the heights of the second world power where it now stands, a status that from which it can be dislodged very likely only by China. Now, the wartime foreign policy of the Kremlin was not in the least either revolutionary or internationalist. It was dominated by the desperate struggle of the masters in the Kremlin for survival. There was rank, unrestrained chauvinism against the German people. The German people, who were the first victims of Nazism, were not differentiated from the Nazi tyrants themselves. There wasn't the slightest trace of the class approach of the Bolsheviks. There was submission to the imperialist allies throughout the war and even before, in the pact with Hitler, and later the alliance with Roosevelt and Churchill. As a gift to Roosevelt, as a pledge that the communist parties would not transgress the limits of private property even when the chance presented itself, Stalin scrapped the Third International in 1943. When Tito's forces struggled with the counter-revolutionary elements oriented toward the Allies in Yugoslavia under the lead of Mikhailovich and the King, the Kremlin demanded that Tito subordinate itself to these elements, which he refused to do, and struck out on an independent path and was given literal or no support by the Russians. At Yalta, there was a conference in which a deal was made between Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt. A division of spheres of influence along the following terms, Eastern Europe would be considered the domain of the Kremlin. Yugoslavia was to be divided 60-40. And Western Europe, from Greece up to Scandinavia, would fall under the supervision of England and the United States by the Western powers. Now, it must be said that Washington begrudgingly had to carry out its bargain so far as Eastern Europe is concerned. Stalin even more faithfully carried out his bargain so far as Western Europe was concerned, because in 1944, when the Greek partisans were in a position to take power, they were held back on advice of the Kremlin, and as a result, we have had the re-establishment of the not only capitalism, but the monarchy in Greece. And as you know from the most recent events, Greek democracy, let alone socialism, has been crippled to this very day. Even worse was what was done in Italy, France, Belgium, where the partisans, which had taken power in a number of places and were ready to mobilize themselves to go forward, were disarmed at the command of the followers of the Soviet leaders. Yugoslavia wasn't able to become a divided prey according to the contract, because you had a victorious independent revolution there, and the people were in a position to settle their own affairs, which was not the case in the other countries, and that made all the difference. In any event, a new international relationship of forces was established as a result of the smashing of capitalism, which greatly enfeebled the whole of the capitalist system. And because of the Soviet military advances, after some hesitation, Stalin took advantage of the more favorable situation and proceeded to cash in on it. At first, he had coalition governments of capitalists and communists and even socialists and peasant parties in the various countries of Eastern Europe. He looted their facilities. He did the same, as you know, with the Chinese industrial installations in Manchuria. Then when the Marshall Plan in 1947-48 threatened his mastery of Eastern Europe, and it appeared that the wartime coalition and any hopes of its continuance had been smashed, the native communist parties, with the backing of the Soviet armies, were encouraged to drive out the representatives of the weakened capitalists and landlords, who were thoroughly discredited in any event because they were tied up with fascism and reaction, to take political control of the countries and create a ring of buffer states and satellite regimes. And this reorientation also impelled a structural reorganization of their economies and the smashing of capitalist relationship of ownership and production. But all these countries remain subordinated to the needs of the Soviet masters, economically, diplomatically, militarily. And it was this subordination which created the conditions for the anti-Kremlin uprisings and feelings of the 1950s. Now, even before these events erupted, there was a warning, a precursor. In the late 40s, the oppressive policy of the Soviet overlords aroused resistance and protest in the country where the workers and peasants had organized themselves and, arms in hand, at great cost, taken the power. The first successful defiance of Moscow came from Belgrade. And it was not at all accidental that it did so. The Tito-Stalin rupture represented the clash of an authentic, independent, national people's revolution, a worker-peasant revolution, with the would-be omnipotent Soviet bureaucracy. Stalin thought he could get away with anything, and with contempt, he is reported to have said, when he was warned that Tito would resist, "I'll crush Tito with my little finger." Well, this only betrayed his lack of understanding and sympathy for the revolutionary temper of the Yugoslavs, which was still hot and ardent. You see, the Soviet rulers feared then, as they do today, whatever they cannot control, whatever they cannot dictate to in the workers' movement. And rightly so, because any manifestation of independence can only encourage independent manifestations on their home grounds from the workers, the peasants, the intellectuals there. Tito's heresy and defiance immediately and permanently became a most unsettling factor throughout Eastern Europe. The purge trials of 1939 in Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania were similar to the 1936-38 Moscow trials. Devoted Stalinist leaders this time, not those people who had been obedient to all the twists and turns of the Comintern, but who still had some connection with their native working-class movement, were framed up, forced into humiliating confessions, and executed. Among them was Gomulka, the present premier of Poland, and Imre Nagy of Hungary. Gomulka is still alive. Nagy, as you know, was executed for his role in the 1956 Hungarian uprising. It was feared that even the slightest breath of independence by any of these individuals would become a rallying ground against a rallying point for dissidents. And so it proved in the case of Gomulka and of Nagy. Meanwhile, even more important developments were taking place in the colonial countries, especially in East Asia. Moscow had the same conservative attitude toward the Third Chinese Revolution as it had toward the Yugoslav Revolution. Stalin agreed to the continuation of an alliance and support of Chiang Kai-shek after the war as during it. And he advised Mao to conciliate with Chiang Kai-shek and try to integrate himself into a coalition regime as the communists were doing in Western Europe. But Mao, like Tito, was caught up in an irresistible wave of peasant revolt in the face of the collapse of the old order. He was confronted with the absolute intransigence of Chiang Kai-shek, who was not ready to give any concessions or compromise in any degree, but set about with American aid to crush the communist-led armed forces. So the CP leaders were faced with the grim alternatives of either capitulating or being crushed, or placing themselves at the head of the peasant masses. They took the latter course and conducted a civil war which threw Chiang off the mainland and established the People's Republic of China in 1949. This new revolutionary victory in the largest population of the world and the dominant one in Asia still more radically altered the balance of forces in world politics and military affairs, and posed very serious problems indeed to the generals and the strategists in the Pentagon and the White House. It led eventually not only to the Korean conflict, but to the present one in Vietnam. But the victory of the Chinese Revolution did more than that. It had not only international repercussions, but very important repercussions within the communist world itself. It changed the relation of forces between the conservative elements and the more militant and radical ones within the Stalinist system. Peking could not, simply because of its size, but even more because of it had won power on its own account, be or become a satellite of Moscow. It had at least to be a partner by virtue of its revolutionary origins and independence. Because the essence of the Chinese Revolution, and on its democratic side, was the securing of national independence from all foreign tutelage. And no Chinese regime could survive if, after getting out from under the Western powers, it would then have to become a steward, even of a workers' state. Moreover, the leaders of the Chinese Communist Party did not feel that they owed anything to Moscow for their supremacy. They were their own boss. The uneasy coalition between Moscow and Peking didn't last more than a decade. I always feel that I had a certain prescience when in 1952 we had a discussion on the perspectives of the Peking regime and its relations with the Soviet leadership, I predicted that precisely because of the dynamics of the Chinese Revolution, it was bound to come into collision with the conservatism of Moscow. But the divergences began to express themselves, although not too clearly or conspicuously, in 1956. They were sharpened in 1959 when Khrushchev came over here and dickered and dallied with Eisenhower at Camp David and then stopped off at Peking and got a very cold reception. And as everyone knows, has culminated now not only in an open break, but in a very sharp conflict. What this has demonstrated is that any independent revolution, any regime arising from such a revolution, has proved incompatible with the selfish, narrow, nationalistic design of the Kremlin oligarchy. Now, this is no longer a theory, a deduction from the Trotskyist analysis of that bureaucracy. It has become a demonstrable and demonstrated fact, one of the biggest in world politics today. Finally, a no less significant event took place in our own hemisphere. The victory of Castro and the establishment of the first worker state in the Americas. This was the first socialist revolution which had conquered without any connection with the Stalinist movement, an historical achievement. Castroism provided a new source and center of inspiration and a different axis around which revolutionary militants could crystallize, especially in Latin America, although its influence has radiated the world over. Now, there were a lot of people who feared that because of its isolation, its weaknesses, its economic necessities, the Cuban leadership would succumb to the blackmail, the pressure, the grip of the Kremlin. There were some of our own comrades who felt that that might actually have happened because of the speech that Castro made at the Tricontinental Conference a year ago last January. But experience, and I read an article in the magazine, or the New Politics, I guess it was, in which a professor of politics at St. Louis University wrote that Castro had completely succumbed to Stalinism, and now that was an inevitable development and could be considered as nothing more than simply a tool of the Kremlin. Well, experience has shown that Castroism is not only non-Stalinist, but it cannot be assimilated by Stalinism. It's incompatible with it. And the breach between Havana and Moscow is widening and deepening all the time. And again, it's not an accident. Post-war experience has shown that the Kremlin has collided with every independent revolution since the Second World War. Now, this is not a new phenomenon. The same thing happened in the 1920s and the 1930s. The major difference is that since 1949, and even before, Moscow has not been able to head them off, certainly not in all cases, or even some of the more important ones, to manipulate or control them for its own ends. In many cases, when the showdown came between the Soviet bureaucracy and the national revolutionary powers, the latter had enough strength to resist and pursue their own course. I'll have a little bit more to say about that later. The hold of the Kremlin, which was broken in Yugoslavia and China, and never clenched in Cuba to the same degree, also became weakened in the satellite states of East Europe following Stalin's death. This process began in East Germany in June of 1953 with the uprising of the East German workers starting in East Berlin. It reached its climax with the uprisings in Poland and Hungary in 1956, through which Poland was partially de-Stalinized, regained a measure of freedom of action when the Kremlin retreated in the face of the united resistance of the Polish workers, army, intellectuals, peasants. A somewhat different development, as you know, took place in regard to Hungary. There the revolution was crushed, but the forcefulness of that revolution has nevertheless had its consequences in a relaxation of the repression and a more liberal regime in that country. And since 1956, the various regimes in Eastern Europe have been exhibiting more and more independence. Two have broken away almost entirely from the orbit of Kremlin diplomacy. Albania, of course, which has a partnership with China and is completely at odds with Moscow, and Romania, which has about the same relation to Moscow that de Gaulle's France has with the United States. Thus, the rebirth of the international revolution and its growing progeny, plus the emergence of national communist bureaucracies with their own state powers to be concerned about and to exercise, have struck one blow after another at the formerly omnipotent sovereignty of the Soviet bureaucracy over world communism, and shattered the monolithism which prevailed in Stalin's time. This monopoly of power can never be reestablished. It is gone forever. The historical conditions which facilitated and permitted it cannot be restored. And that is evident in the Moscow-Peking rift and their contest for allegiance of the different communist states and parties. It's disclosed in the independent course being taken by the Cubans, in the polycentrism of the communist parties on a world scale. You can discern a number of tendencies among them. On the right, there is what is known as the Italian tendency, which goes more and more in the direction of the social democratization of the communist parties, especially in Western Europe. Of the communist regimes themselves, the most right-wing is, of course, the Yugoslav, which supported the United States in the Korean War and has been castigated by the Cubans and others for their perfidious neutralist stand in the Vietnam intervention. In the center, we have the Eastern European countries and the Soviet Union. A little bit to the left, the Peking regime in Albania. Still further to the left, the North and South Vietnamese, the North Koreans, and the Cubans. The last being closest to the genuine revolutionary current of the Fourth International. And that's the present disposition of polycentric forces on the left the world over. Trotsky wrote in the founding program of the Fourth International, "The laws of the class struggle are more powerful than any bureaucratic apparatus." Now, it doesn't seem so to a lot of people who get discouraged sometimes and don't have a wide historical horizon. But just think about this. No bureaucracy could be stronger than the Soviet bureaucracy was. Just look at what it had. It had the prestige of the first workers' state. It had originally the Third International. It had immense material resources. The second military machine in the world, later equipped with nuclear weapons. And yet, it couldn't halt the progress of the world revolution, despite the harm its policies committed and continue to inflict. Not only that, it couldn't even prevent its own satellite from resisting and gaining a margin of independence. It can, of course, still do considerable damage, slow down the world revolution and divert it from its true course. But it has not been able to and will not be able to hold back the wheel of world history. That is to say, the course of the class struggle on the global arena. And this has an immense and important application for the socialist movement of the United States. Because in our trade union movement, there is the most powerfully entrenched bureaucracy that any capitalist country has ever known. Certainly it has far more resources than any group of trade union leaders had ever anticipated in their wildest imagination having. At the present moment, they seem omnipotent, and they themselves think that they're going to go on forever. Well, I was over at Solidarity House today, and everything looked so efficient and quiet and undisturbed, just like General Motors Corporation headquarters. Yeah. And I met with some of our ex-comrades there. I said, "Oh, how times have changed since I was in Detroit in 1942. Yeah. But Solidarity House is going to be shaken up. Don't worry about that, some one of these days. And I trust that the next time some of our comrades go there, it will be under different circumstances. So far, I have focused attention on the developments in world politics and the international class struggle that have been unfavorable to the grip of Stalinism. And properly so in the first instance, because what happens in the world at large is ultimately decisive in determining the career and fortunes of the Soviet bureaucracy as well as everything else in this world. They were the prime beneficiaries of the defeats of the masses and the counter-revolutionary character of the 20 years, politically speaking, from 1923 to 1943. They have increasingly become the targets and the victims of the successes of the workers and peasants and the spread of the colonial revolution in the 24 years since. And that's the basic way you have to approach what has happened to them. Of course, this is a closed road to the ordinary bourgeois commentators, but it happens to be the reality. These post-war developments, in addition, have settled, by the test of practice, the great dispute between Stalin and Trotsky over the permanent revolution and its processes versus socialism in one country. What was the essence of their argument and the differences between them? The Stalinists declared, let the revolution elsewhere wait, mark time, be crippled and even crushed, while the Communist Party creates the conditions for a socialist society within the Soviet borders. No, the Trotskyists answered, your course is utopian, reactionary, anti-Marxist, and opportunist, injurious to world socialism and injurious and unrealistic. It can now be seen that even despite the policies and interference of the Kremlin, the socialist revolution has taken power in countries on three continents before socialism has been established in the Soviet Union. Of course, Stalin falsely claimed as early as 1935 that the Soviet Union had already achieved socialism, and Khrushchev echoes him and redoubles the claim by saying that it's on its way to communism. But actually, Soviet society is only halfway on the road to socialism, if that far, and in any event, has not attained the desired goal. A country that in 1960 couldn't raise enough crops to feed its people and had to buy wheat from Canada is quite removed from a socialist society of abundance, even in that elementary field of production. And I don't have to speak about the state of liberties for its citizens and the working class, which is about as far from socialism and its democracy as you can get. Now, this brings us to the internal processes that have undermined the grip of the Soviet bureaucracy, that have changed the relation of forces between the ruling caste since the close of World War II and the Soviet people. I can only run through them briefly, for lack of time. There's first of all the economic advances. The five-year plans, however mismanaged, did lay the foundation of Soviet industrialization. This was damaged and interrupted by the devastation of the war because of the resilience of a socialized economy the Soviet Union made a very rapid comeback, and today it has mounted from an industrially weak to a highly developed industrialized society. It has made spectacular achievements in heavy industry, science, education, and half a hundred fields. It is, of course, economically a rather lopsided development. Heavy industry has grown at the expense of other departments. Light industry, that is, the production of consumers' goods, is still, although going forward, not at all up to that of other advanced countries. Its services are rather meager, and agriculture remains its Achilles heel. There has been a parallel transformation in the components of its social structure. Whereas there were only 5 million workers, and at times even less in the early days, there are today 55 million workers in the Soviet Union, mostly young and technically qualified, probably next to that of the United States, the most highly qualified labor force in the entire world. The Soviet intelligentsia has made tremendous strides in the fields of technology, science, arts, and literature. And in some cases, they lead the world. It has a questioning youth that is going to be heard from.